Enrique Chi is the front man for the band Making Movies. Right now, it's safe to say they're one of Kansas City's big success stories. They got a nod in the Latin Grammys. Steve Berlin of Los Lobos has produced their records. But once upon a time in the not-so-distant past, they were just kids, taking any gig they could get anywhere in the country. There was no money involved. They were crashing on couches.
And our little van that we had been using as our vehicle was on its deathbed.
But their work eventually paid off, or so they thought. They were asked to perform for Ozomatli, one of the biggest Latin rock bands ever in Chicago. And Enrique thought,
if they like us, this is the breakthrough moment.
So they ditched their broken down van and crammed into two cars, a little Scion and a Jeep, with all their gear. And they made it to Chicago.
We had a day off, and we were so excited. This is what we need. We're going to go to the lake. And as we go inside to grab a couple of things to go to the lake, Brendan's car is smoking. There was some kind of leak in his power steering that would make his car smoke sometimes. He's like, it just does that sometimes. And we're looking from the window, and we're going, Brendan, your car is smoking a lot. And as by the time we all gather around this second-story apartment window, the front of his Jeep, the engine, is up in flames.
Wait, it gets worse. The laptop they'd just saved up for was in that car. Their drum kit was in that car. All their merchandise was in that car.
And so we run down to the car, and the amazing, like Murphy's Law of life, Brendan's back door for the Jeep sometimes gets stuck and doesn't open from the outside, only from the inside. This happened to be one of those times. So now we're watching as the flames are getting closer and closer to our equipment in this car. I mean, I couldn't believe what I was watching. And as this car's up in flames, I thought, this is certainly the end of the band.
Amazingly, the fire department arrived just in time to save their stuff, but not in time to save the Jeep. So now the band has to make it to the show and back to Kansas City with just one compact car and a ton of equipment.
So we had to ask a favor from the venue to see if they could house it for 2 days till the show. We had to ask friends to help us get the equipment there. To go to the concert itself, a few people could drive and a few people had to take the train.
But finally, they make it to the show, and it's kind of a frenetic set, but totally worth it, right?
The band Ozomatli was at dinner while we played, so they didn't even notice us. Nothing came of it. It was just kind of a letdown.
The band rode home on a bus called El Conejo, and when they got home, the mood was somber.
The three of us are sitting there waiting for our rides, and it's a beautiful sunny day, but we are silent, and there's nothing to say to each other. And it was unspoken, but we all knew that everyone was thinking, what are we doing? Are we really going to do this?
Believe it or not, Enrique still considers this his breakthrough moment.
Because I had to decide in that moment that, am I going to take this path even if it means disasters sometimes? It means riding in a conejo through the night to get back home. If it means cars blowing up and being junked in Chicago. And I felt comfortable deciding that, yes, I am going to take this path.
3 months later, Making Movies opened for Los Lobos at Knuckleheads, and that changed everything. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, Enrique Chi of Making Movies. We'll hear his story, the story that took him from Panama to Missouri, and then from Missouri to number 3 on the Latin Billboard charts. Enrique Chi, good morning.
Good morning.
Do you like ever imagine what the guy on that bus coming home from Chicago would think if he could see into the future and know what's happened with Making Movies since then?
No, it's hard to picture it because you feel, you know, when you're in, when you're living the things that you were wishing to do, it's hard to picture back. Like, man, is this how I thought it would be? Those kind of feelings, and certainly as we were sitting on that bus, this is not how I thought rock and roll was going to be. You know, as we're driving that bus home, so. I guess I'm definitely hearing the story. I'm glad I made the choice I made. It's been quite the roller coaster.
Ruben Blades is a, a salsa legend, and he gave you a shout out during the Latin Grammys. He was interviewed on the red carpet, and someone asked him what younger acts had caught his attention, and making movies was basically his answer, which that must have been an incredible moment for you.
It's funny because we still run our own record label. And so a big part of managing our own careers and business is our own choices and how we plan our lives. So we were loading into a gig in San Diego, and we were literally all complaining. We're like, why are we so bad at this that we have booked a California tour and we're going to arrive to Los Angeles when everyone who matters is 4 hours away in Las Vegas at the Latin Grammys? We're like, next year, we can't do this. This is foolish, you know, bad planning. And a tweet came through from a journalist at Univision that was on the red carpet, and this is on the live broadcast, you know, the international broadcast of the Latin Grammys. And she tweeted, she's like, oh my God, Ruben Blades just shouted out making movies, because she knew us. And she knew the place that we're at. We're not at a place where somebody like Ruben Blades would normally be privy to us or, you know, be wanting to sing our praises at the red carpet.
Yeah, an up-and-coming act to him, you know?
Yes, exactly. So, and everybody, like, the kind of weight he carries in that world, like, his discography is kind of synonymous to his Latin Grammys. Like, he just puts something out, and everybody in that community says, yeah, of course, absolutely the greatest. I mean, his nickname is El Maestro, the Master. So there's this, like, weight when he speaks, and, man, we were screaming like little schoolgirls, just like... The reason he found out about us is because I yap about him all the time. When people ask me, who's your biggest influence? I say him, because not only musically, and he's Panamanian and all this other stuff, but there's this really tangible thing where he had enough depth lyrically, and he was Beatle influenced by his chord changes and movements, that my dad could really get into it. This like kind of psychedelic rock fanatic who doesn't like to dance very much, but does it because he loves my mom. He does dance.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, it is. And my mom, who never knows who sings what and what any song's about, but will dance the second there's a danceable rhythm, Ruben Blades was the meeting ground in our home. So from a personal note, it was just so magical.
We are going to focus on your personal story, and we're going to get there. But for listeners who aren't familiar with your music, let's start with some music. I mean, Making Movies is a band of friends and brothers, right?
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about who's in the band and the idea behind it.
Well, the band now is, in my opinion, the strongest iteration, because it's Juan Carlos and Andres are brothers, and they're the rhythm section. And then Diego and I are brothers, and we're the guitars and the core of the harmonic bass of the band. We started out with Brendan, whose vehicle blew up, and Brendan has become a brother to us over the course of the 8 or 9 years that we played music together, and he's still part of the family and part of the tribe, but there's been this special sibling thing that is hard to explain, you know. Everybody kind of speaks an intuitive language. My girlfriend always complains, or not complains, she just laughs about the fact that, like, we don't speak in complete sentences to each other at all, or complete thoughts. It's kind of just grunt language. Because we're all siblings, so we just don't have to say very much.
Your first album was A La Deriva. Tell me about this album.
The idea of the album was to kind of represent a neighborhood in Kansas City, specifically like the immigrant communities. We hadn't really seen the world yet, and we had seen that, and that's kind of what we wanted to write about. And the concept is to all the music in the Americas, all the folk music from North and South America. When I say America, that's what I'm referring to. It all has these deep Afro roots, and in any port city, whether you're in New Orleans or you're Havana, Cuba, or if you're in Portobello, Panama, the Afro roots get mixed with indigenous, get mixed with the European culture. And we just felt like if that's the basis for all music in the Americas, then we can totally screw everything up and just go back to the root of it, the African core, this West African beats, Yoruba rhythms, and then write whatever experimental music we want on top of it. And A La Deriva was the first time that I think that we could complete that thought and actually be like, okay, that is the concept of this band. And the deeper we went with the rhythms, the more universal the music became, even though the rhythms were weirder or more complex or less mainstream or commercial or something.
Seems like it's about a 50-50 split between singing in Spanish and singing in English.
Yeah, with this album, it wasn't intentional. With the newest album, there was some intention with the language switches, but it just kind of felt like my life is roughly in that way, split up between different friends and families. So when I write, it kind of comes out that way as well.
You know, we're going to talk pretty soon about your upcoming albums, the ones after A La Deriva, but the sound on the album that we were just hearing a little bit of, it's pretty mellow but still upbeat and dancey for the most part. In these later two albums, which are companions, your sound gets a lot more range. Like, it becomes impossible to say whether you're even making just one kind of music. American Songwriter magazine actually calls your most recent album rock, cumbia, psychedelia, American roots, song cubano, and spoken word. And that is a lot of genres.
Yeah, it's just music, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, okay, let's listen to, you have this I Am Another You and then a companion album, You Are Another Me. If you could just briefly explain the concept there.
I Am Another You kind of continues this story of wanting to relate our own experiences and our family's experiences. So I was in a time period in my life where kind of a coming of age, and a lot of my friends were too. And I had three specific friends who each were going through really tough circumstances. But one is my cousin in Latin America. One's a Mexican American. Another one was just a Kansas City like kid I grew up with. And what I wanted to make a record that sounded the way my life felt, where these people are from such diverse backgrounds, yet the core things they desire and are striving for are the same. So the album is so diverse on a surface level, but I think the songs are tied on a kind of a deeper soul level where they actually do work together in a really intentional way.
Let's hear how You Are Another Me begins.
Hola, primo. Disculpa que no te regrese la llamada. Mira, hemos estado viajando como locos y tocando, pero aquí te quiero mandar un par de temas, las canciones. Yo creo que tienen un nuevo significado en esta época. Bueno, primo, espero que lo disfrutes. Un abrazo. Yo te quiero mucho. Chao.
Love this cover of Bob Marley's Redemption Song.
Thank you.
You know, there are a lot of covers on this album, and it's interesting because some of them are sort of obvious protest songs like this one, but there are others that are maybe less obvious choices, and I think it's fair to call this a protest album.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's funny, people said that about I Am Another You, and it, to me, it wasn't. I was just trying to describe stories of my family. It just happened to be that my cousin was dealing with immigration struggles, but he's dealing with racism and xenophobia from Venezuela to Panama, not having anything to do with Donald Trump or anything in the United States. But people were like, this is a protest album, just talking about immigration and talking about human rights and the right for people to feel accepted, or people have empathy for immigrants. People are like, you're making protest music. I was like, oh, I guess. So I was like, well, screw it. They're already calling it protest music. I'm going to make an intentional protest EP. And the name of it, You Are Another Me, although it spins off the album's title, it also is kind of calling out these artists and saying, you know, we're in the same train of thought. You've been singing about this. Or Bob Marley was singing about this 30 years ago. We're not so different in the things that we feel, you know, and so we did our best to do those songs and those themes justice.
The story that I have read, anyway, about your recording of I Am Another You is pretty crazy, though. I mean, you had gone to record in Memphis, and on that trip, you went to the National Civil Rights Museum just as the Trump administration announced plans to end the DACA program. And it seems like you channeled some of your response to both of those experiences into that recording.
Definitely. That morning, there's a song called De Paisano a Paisano. We had already decided that we wanted to record it. And the morning where we were set out to record it, we woke up and on our phones was Jeff Sessions, who's saying that he is canceling the DACA program where the administration currently is. And that weighed so heavily with us because we know so many young people in that position. And as we recorded De Paisano a Paisano, the band felt really focused on the sentiment of that song. And it turned out that way. That song on the original version is very upbeat and dancey. And in the version that we did, we pulled out a more melancholy sound around the lyrics. And it really informed. I mean, that is what we're trying to say. It's like, look, if you've never been in this situation and you can't exactly feel these feelings, like perhaps music can help you realize what it might be like to be in one of those circumstances.
Well, we'll get back to your music, but this seems like a good time to step back and tell your story, which begins in Panama.
Yeah, I was born in Santiago, Panama, this little town with three stoplights. My grandmother had married a half Panamanian, half Chinese guy who was studying medicine in New Orleans in Tulane. And she married him, and, you know, in that time period, I think that she was maybe 21 years old. Like a year later, they moved to Panama with my dad and my uncle in tow, and my dad was maybe a year and a half old. And the rest of her life, she spent there in Santiago, and that's the same town where I was born. And so my family already came from a bilingual route because my dad had to speak both languages because his mom didn't speak Spanish for many years. She's such a tough woman. She passed away last year, But she, she told me the stories of, like, music was the moment, where the moment she understood all the lyrics to a Spanish song was the moment she realized, oh, I speak Spanish now.
Oh, that's cool.
And this is in an era where, like, there's no English programming in rural Central America in 1963. You know, she was really isolated. And so I think that those sentiments are kind of built into my DNA. And my dad and mom wanted to move to the States to study some more. They're very religious people, and they met some families from a church here in this city, and they were like, hey, come here. This is a great place. If you want to be here for 4 years, this is a very great city to come to, quiet. We'll help set you up. And we had some family in Miami, but my dad never really liked Miami very much. The hustle and bustle, I think, kind of threw him off. And so he said, well, this feels like the right thing. And to their credit, a few of those families are still, you know, really deep, close relationships that my parents maintain. But we moved here when I was 6 years old, and my parents heard about this school in, you might as well have said, you know, a word in Chinese, but Lee Summit, that there was this ESL program there that somebody had heard was doing really great. And so my parents rented an apartment there so that I could go to this English as a second language, this ESL program. And that's where I ended up finishing growing up. 1 year led to another, and they stayed. They just moved back to Panama 3 years ago.
Wow. You know, do you remember your first impressions of Kansas City and Lee Summit?
Totally. I was just flying out to New York because I'm currently in the middle of a tour with another artist. A friend of ours, Las Cafeteras, needed a guitar player for a tour. And so I took off 3 weeks ago, and as we're leaving, and it was kind of a clear day, I could see Kansas City looked like with a wintry, you know, Midwestern plains from the airplane. And it just brought back a memory of being six and on an airplane and looking down and being like, where are we moving to? Like in Panama, it's like a jungle. Like humans should probably not live there. Like nature is just so willing to overtake anything. You can't leave anything outside. You can't leave a car parked and not maintain it, like the jungle will literally eat it up. Like it'll just be consumed by plants. And so everything's green and hot and muggy. And we moved in like October and it had already turned quite cold. As we're landing, it's this barren, desolate looking landscape.
Oh, I've seen it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, and I was like, where are we moving to, Mom? So, yeah, it was.
Did she have an answer for you, or was she equally freaked out?
She was equally freaked out, but she was keeping it cool because my mom and dad had been separated for 5 months. It's something people don't realize. You know, I think there's like a real lack of understanding of how difficult it is to immigrate anywhere, and specifically in the United States. It's been pretty difficult over the last 20, 30 years. My dad is an American citizen, was born here, and speaks English. And for him to come here and get things ready for my parents to reunite, it took half a year with an American citizen to get the paperwork right. So you can only imagine if you don't have access to some of those. Oh, and the language barrier not being an issue. My dad's fluent in English. My mom, I think, was just keeping it together. Like, I haven't seen my husband in 6 months. I've been raising these two little boys by myself, like a single mom all of a sudden. You know, this is a decision we made, so I better act tough. And she did.
How did your parents meet?
High school. They're high school sweethearts that ended up together.
You know, so you arrive, your first impression is from the airplane, and it's not good. I mean, do you remember, like, those early, not just that first impression from the plane, but those early days and weeks and months of adjustment to that school, that great ESL program you'd heard about?
I do. I remember one of the family friends who's still in our lives, a man named H.B. Watson, and he taught me my first English word having arrived. He taught me knucklehead.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's an interesting first word.
It is. It's kind of fun to say. I remember that it was like, that's fun to say, knucklehead. I knew water and food and a few other words. But I remember that. I remember that there's a few people being very warm and kind. I remember that. I remember the experience of the bus route never figuring out where I lived. So since I wasn't technically in the district of the said school, but I was in the district of the school of that school district, so they would have to have a special extra route in the bus for me. And multiple times they screwed it up. I think my first day of school, it was supposed to be a half day, and I didn't get off the bus because they didn't actually take me home. And so they brought me back to the school where I sat there in the principal's office. And my mom, you know, there's no cell phones, and I couldn't speak English. I couldn't explain. And I remember I remember the adults talking around me like, the mannerisms and stuff were basically like, I don't know where this kid came from. I don't know where he's supposed to go. He doesn't seem to speak, you know, and I'm just looking up wide-eyed like, how do I get home and where am I?
It's funny because I can imagine the tones of voice that would have sounded like without the meaning of the words.
That's been that's a huge thing for me. I sometimes still slip into that where I stop paying attention to what people say with their words, but what they say with their tone. And there's a musicality to language. And you can, sometimes people lie a lot with their words and tell the truth a lot more with their body language, with the way that the cadence of their speech. You can really hear things like fear, like love, acceptance, judgment. You can hear it if you just stop listening to the words and you listen to someone's the literal sound of their voice communicates so much. And perhaps that was a survival skill for me. Like, it was the way I knew that it was time to go to the bathroom. Like, I could, like, oh, the teacher kind of sounds like this and everybody's posture does this. Oh, we're lining up. Yes, I had to pee. Perfect. You know? And so I use it as a survival skill, but I think it's also helped me develop musically, because that's the space where music comes from.
When you were, you know, in that experience of trying to understand how people were receiving you, not through necessarily their words, but through other signs, what was your perception of how you were being received at school and in the larger community here?
I think that it's an amazing lesson for anyone, that how one person can have such a huge impact, especially on a child's perception of the world. In hindsight, there was a lot more judgment and racism around me than I realized. And I've like sat and kind of processed this. And I think it really ties to this one amazing ESL teacher who just made me feel safe. She didn't speak Spanish, but she spoke my language. She could play with me. She would play with me to teach me English. And she was the kind of woman that just went above and beyond for any of the immigrant families that came into the community. She would be at their homes late at night, helping them fill out paperwork, tax forms, just nothing to do with her job. Just it was part of her heart. These people are here and they need help. And I have the resources to help them, so I'm going to. That feeling, I think it helped cover a lot of other negative experiences that maybe I was having but didn't really perceive them.
Enrique Chi of Making Movies, hang on with me through this break, okay?
Of course.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to this portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking to Enrique Chi of the band Making Movies about his childhood in Kansas City and Lee's Summit, where he moved with his family from Santiago, Panama. And Enrique, you were just talking about the ESL teacher who made a really big difference in your life by speaking your language, as you said, in spite of not speaking Spanish. But you were also saying that the really powerful, positive influence she had on you kind of made up for a lot of not so great things that you didn't even kind of notice at the time. What sort of stuff are you talking about?
I think that school, for example, the only immigrant kids, there's about 10 inside of a school of 500 people. We all rode to school literally on a short bus. So after they figured out this bus routing thing, that like there was a couple other families that arrived and had heard of this program, so they designated a smaller shuttle bus of sorts to go around. But it was literally one of those buses for mentally handicapped people. So there's like the extra seat belts and stuff. So, elementary school kids, that's pretty hilarious that you have to ride the mentally handicapped bus to school. So things like that, you know, where you're just kind of segregated into a different part of the community, and you have to leave class every day at certain hours to go do the ESL program. It's hard for me to remember exact teasing or taunting or that kind of stuff. But I know it existed because I didn't make any friendships. I made really pretty much no friendships at school for a long time. And my friend was actually this teacher. Like, that's in my mind, my friend at school was this, I think, probably 60-year-old lady at the time.
Did you miss Panama?
So much. And I think it shaped my perception of things. If you can imagine your 6-year-old mind, you've only been conscious, having memory for maybe a year or two. And it took about 2 years for us to go visit Panama. So for as long as I could remember, I for equally long, I had to kind of erase my memory of everybody and everything that I'd ever seen and knew. And so I think that has played a role in my own, like, you know, psychological development. I struggle to miss things because I think at that age, it hurt so much to miss that I just like deleted that part of my, normal emotional development or something like that. So I think I did, but I don't remember processing it. I actually have struggled to remember a lot of those years.
Do you, you were saying that your parents have recently moved back to Panama. Did you travel back there to visit family a lot, or?
We did. After a couple of years, my parents got financially a little more stable. So we would make a point to visit every other year. And that was great. I would sometimes complain that, like, you know, oh, when we have a vacation, we always only do one thing, which is go visit family. But we had the real blessing of being able to go back and forth because we had legal status here too. So there wasn't a fear that, like, if we go back, we won't be able to be let back into the country. So some people, when they immigrate, that's even more intense because that's it. They cut ties for very long amounts of time because they're afraid of moving back and forth.
How did music enter your life?
Well, I always loved it. Since I was, before I even spoke English, there's a song by the band called The Dire Straits. My family remembers me dancing around and loving it. And I would sing it, you know, whatever mumbo jumbo I was singing. And so I've always loved it. I would stand up next to my dad. He would play guitar at church. And I had like a toy guitar that I would stand up there and I'd just play my toy guitar next to him until he was done playing. So for me, I think I've always just been attracted to it, but it carved out a special role for me that as a young person in this time period where I felt a little isolated and hadn't made a lot of friendships. I remember the first time I met a kid who spoke Spanish. We were like at a church party. It was one of the families actually that my parents met when they were in Panama. And he spoke Spanish. He just moved from Costa Rica to the U.S. about a year before me. And he remembers the story too, that I wouldn't stop talking because I hadn't been able to talk to a kid for like 6 months or maybe longer. So I was just like so excited, like, oh my God, I can talk to you. This is amazing. You'd understand what I'm saying. You know, so he's like, oh my God, you would not shut up. You just yapping, 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 yapping. But I think that like for me, music, when that feeling of being isolated, music was a refuge. I could listen to the stories in the music and I could hear a bigger world, even if it's rock and roll and it's, you know, I don't know, if you hear Pink Floyd, you realize there's more to the world than Lee's Summit, Missouri. There's bigger ideas, there's bigger soundscapes and stuff like that. That must come from somewhere, you know, or you hear New York jazz or you hear the salsa movement or Latin American music. It paints these pictures and gives you the feelings of these dense cities or these really multicultural environments. And so for me, I think music was that window to remember there's a bigger world than this kind of small town experience I'm having right now.
Do you think of the Midwestern part of your upbringing and maybe even the suburban Midwestern part of your upbringing as being a big part of not just who you are, but the music you make? I mean, I ask this because Remezcla, which is a news source for Latin culture, they've said that your band Making Movies is breaking down barriers for Latinos in the heartland specifically, which I think that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, I think it did. I think that I was thinking about this recently with coming back, and it's been kind of a bitter winter. So I came back from some traveling and it's like, oh man, even just like the weather here kind of gives you inclinations to certain, preferences or habits, right? You know, you drink a little more coffee and you listen to sometimes a little darker music or something, like when it's dreary outside. There's like winter records that sound good when it's cold. And then there's like records that sound good when you're on the beach. And so I think that even just that simple fact played an influence. But the ignorance that I experienced as a kid, most kids did not have any idea where on the map Panama is, what part of Mexico Panama is such a common question I grew up with.
Wow.
A pretty common question I still get if I'm like outside of a city center in the Midwest is, what are you? Like, you ain't Mexican. I can tell that. What are you?
Whoa.
That's like...
Well, how do you answer that?
I'm usually kind of flippant these days. I say human, you know?
You consider that flippant, to say that you're human?
Well, yeah, it's a snarky response. I understand what they're trying to ask me. Sometimes they pedal back and go, I don't mean any disrespect. Like, I've never met anybody like you. Sometimes they're not being rude. But it's just happened so many times in my life that... Still happens, like, that I'm just like, that's not an okay question. That's not the way you're supposed to frame that question.
So, I mean, in the middle of this experience, when you're discovering that music can connect you to the world beyond your immediate surroundings, how did you meet your bandmates, the other brothers? You know, how did that connection happen?
It was a really important day in my life in hindsight, but a day that I wouldn't have counted as being so important. The Matty Rhodes Center, somebody contacted me, knew that I played music, and asked me to perform their little Dia de los Muertos festival that they host right out front of Primitivo Garcia. I wonder if my connection was because I had gotten a gig ESL tutoring at Primitivo Garcia when I was like 17 or 18. I don't remember how I got asked to perform because nobody knew who we were or who I was at the time, but somebody found out and they asked me to perform. And we performed, and then there's like baile folclórico, like Mexican folkloric dance. And there's kids doing painting workshops, and this muralist, Joe Faust, was running the art program at that time, an after-school kind of drop-in center, and they were selling like the art projects they'd made to raise money for the nonprofit. And I just thought the whole thing was really beautiful, and I didn't live, like I said, I lived in Lee's Summit, so I didn't even realize there was such a dense immigrant community in Kansas City Up until that moment, I became an adult and was becoming more active in the community. And I asked the director, I was like, hey, is there any way that I can, like, volunteer? Like, I remember what it's like to just move here. Could I, like, just, like, drop in and teach guitar lessons or, some, you know, something? He goes, yeah, you got to meet Joe Faust. He's running the after-school program. We'll connect you. And that day, there's this lady who's like, oh, did you see those kids perform? Those are our kids from the Ballet Folklorico group. We're called Grupo Totonilco. I really liked your music. You're very talented. You have to meet my sons. They are very talented and very handsome.
So she was making, she was matchmaking.
She was matchmaking. And our first meeting was at her family.
Parents like to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And we were at the, she's like, I have a restaurant right up the street, La Fonda del Taquito. You could even perform there maybe if you want to. And I was like, okay, cool. And I think we exchanged information. And later on, a few months later, we actually linked up with Juan Carlos, who's her son, her talented, and, you know, I'll let you guys decide if he's very handsome or not. But with her talented son, and we started playing music together, and the rest is history. But what's kind of the reason why I tell the whole story is because for 7 years now, we've run a music camp at the Matty Rhodes Center that was born out of, like, hey, could I stop by and drop in? The music camp's evolved into a nonprofit that, like, in the next week or two, we'll be launching the full website and announcing a festival that we're curating as the fundraiser for expanding the camp into a fall.
And the camp, explain what that is.
Oh, it's called the Matty Rhodes Rocks Camp. And we host it at the Matty Rhodes Center, the same center that I went and volunteered in all those years ago. And it was really based off this need that those kids, when I showed up, they didn't even conceptualize that they could learn to play the guitar. So I didn't show up and, like, be like, hey, who wants to play the guitar? And have kids sign up and then I teach them. It was way more, like, organic than that. And it was like psychologically so far behind that. Not that these kids didn't have the talent, but they just believed it was not something they would ever get to do. So you couldn't really convince them that it was possible. I mean, even just possible to learn to play. Like, that's not really something people like me do. And so we decided to create a camp that would shatter down or break down those kind of walls in their head of, like, everything's possible. So the camp is just this experience music thing. You show up, you play piano, drums, guitar, you sing, you songwrite, and you have to try everything. And at the end of the week, you perform and hopefully perform doing something you'd never thought you could do.
You know, speaking of things that people never thought they could do, I mean, we've mentioned before that it was when your band making movies, you know, you and your brother and then two brothers who you met just through happenstance on Kansas City's West Side, that you caught the attention of Steve Berlin from Los Lobos. And that is what really changed things. Can you tell, like, just the short version of that story?
Yeah, certainly. And I'll add one more thing about the Matty Rhodes Center. Jose Faust, the guy who was running the after-school program, did our cover art for our new album. So many things.
Full circle.
Yeah, so many things converged that day. Well, we had gotten some buzz, like gotten to play a really cool show in Chicago where our vehicle blew up, like we told. So we had some buzz. So people in Kansas City were noticing, okay, this is a band that's actually out there working and doing good things. So Knuckleheads gave us an amazing opportunity. Frank gave us an amazing opportunity to open up for Los Lobos. And I walked into that situation thinking, certainly they'll be at dinner and nothing will come of this. We'll make a few fans. We'll have some fun. Invited my dad to play. Invited Juan Carlos' dad to sit in with us.
But you kept your expectations in check.
I did. No magic will happen tonight. It'll just be whatever. But Steve thought it was we were overhead music. He liked it. He's like, certainly this isn't a Kansas City band. So what music is happening out there? And so he poked his head out of the tour bus and realized, oh, that's a live band. Watched the set, texted the rest of his bandmates, like, you guys need to come see this. This is really good. And so all the band ended up watching us from the crowd. And after the gig, they invited us on stage to jam with them. And after the gig, Steve goes, if you want to make a record, call me first. And I postured and said, okay, yeah, sounds good. I didn't have anybody else to call. So it was pretty easy to make that choice and call him first.
When we return, a little more music from Making Movies' newest album and their Immigrants Are Beautiful tour on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is a portrait session with Enrique Chi. Stay with us. Thank you. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and this show is a portrait session with Enrique Chi, the frontman for Making Movies. And that means that later on there will be Enrique's story alongside a photographic portrait by Paul Andrews. Enrique, we started this show kind of talking out about your music, and I want to get back to that because right now you have out your most recent album, You Are Another Me, is, as you've said, like it's the deliberate protest album following on maybe an accidental one. And also you've got a tour that you've just done, Immigrants Are Beautiful, which is not a subtle name for a tour.
No, people kept saying, why'd you name your tour something so controversial? And that to me is screwed up in and of itself, that sentence is controversial. I have this belief, and I think it's pretty easy to believe this. You would have to be blind not to. And it's that all humans, all mankind, is the product of so much migration, immigration, movement, change. Even the Native American communities, you can link them back to Asian ancestry. And you can link back. I was at the Anthropological Museum in Chicago, and there's exchanges of artifacts from all the way to St. Louis, all the way down to Panama. So these communities were moving, were migrating, were interacting. Imagine all the borders they were crossing as they did those things. And so if you are a human being, you have immigrant ancestry. Just like if you are a human being, you have ancestors who committed genocide, you have ancestors who were extremely brilliant and influential human beings, and you have ancestors who were maybe very evil. That's part of being human. All of our DNA comes from all these amazing parts of the world. Like, go spit in a tube and find out. You know, it really is incredible. So when I'm saying immigrants are beautiful, I'm saying the human story is beautiful in its darkness, in its struggles, in its passion. So I find it fascinating that people are so afraid of that word, especially when, at least in this part of the world, and I actually think in most every part of the world, if you look back a couple generations, your family immigrated from somewhere.
You know, we were talking about that on your most recent album, there are a lot of cover songs, but that you put a really different spin on them. And I think people will probably recognize, a lot of people will recognize this song, what the original is, but I've never... Honestly, for some reason, I've never thought about it as a protest song before, and I did for the first time hearing you perform it. Let's hear a little, and then we'll talk about it.
Sounds great.
Chi of Making Movies, you know, everybody wants to rule the world, Tears for Fears. You've done something that's like the opposite of what you did with Bob Marley's Redemption song, I feel like, because that you made that song so much in a way through your instrumental treatment of it, kind of darker and maybe more halting or uncertain. I mean, it's like if you tied that to the message, like uncertain about whether redemption is coming, but this Everybody Wants to Rule the World is almost cheerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the original song is sarcastic. Everybody wants to rule the world, and it's about how like this like power lust is a threat to the beauty of mankind, you know? And so I thought that was such a fascinating, I always loved the song, but when I heard this lyric, like, we're holding hands when the walls come tumbling down, I think the song was playing radio overhead, and it was right when Trump started to campaign. I was like, man, that's, yeah, holding hands while walls come tumbling down. Like, maybe everybody shouldn't rule the world. This desire for power is not something to praise, you know? Like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have leaders, but I think people really, really, like, take pride in, like, oh, look at everything that this person's conquered. It's like, that's screwed up, because they have, in order for somebody to rise above, you have to put other people down, and so there's some necessity to structure in the world. I'm not like an anarchist by any means, but we should be more cautious of exalting winners in a capitalistic sense, or in a, you know, electoral sense or whatever. I mean, I feel like Trump's like whole thing is like, I'm gonna be a leader because look at how much I've squashed everything else, all my competition out, and I am a successful capitalist. It's like, is that really something we can all applaud right now? Like, that's worth applauding? Like, so anyways, I just thought that it would be really fun to play the song. And the song is built upon this 3-against-2 pulse that is a shuffle rhythm. So it's a shuffle rhythm that New Orleans played, and it's a shuffle rhythm that was brought to New Orleans by the Afro community. Like, a blues song goes, and that same rhythm is in African Bata music. And oppressors always, they would abuse that rhythm or take advantage of it, like when the slave ships were coming over and they had too many African Americans dying. The Spaniards would grab the musicians and have them play those rhythms, their spiritual rhythms, on the drums to keep people alive. Yet when they brought them to Mexico, they said, ah, those drums, it's not very Catholic of you to play that African rhythm, so you can't play them. So the indigenous and the African communities would reinterpret the rhythms onto the guitars. So that huapango rhythm that we put this song to is that Mexican adaptation. And at the same time as our president is saying things like, Mexican communities full of gangsters, or they're bad hombres, and all these kind of vile remarks about an entire community that's so vibrant and beautiful. We said, you know what? This is in a direct opposition of that kind of language. Everybody shouldn't want to rule the world, and we're going to put this to an Afro-Mexican rhythm that inspires us and reminds us that if you love the blues and rock and roll, you have to pay tribute to Latin music, to the port cities of America, to disenfranchised communities, and to oppressors. That's how that music was born. And so that's what we play that song for.
It's hard. I would have never thought of putting, there's something about the 1980s. It's not emblematic as a time period of protest music or, I don't know, social justice movements. That's not the decade you think of.
Mm-mm.
And it was interesting to me to hear that you included that influence on your album. And I was kind of wondering if that's maybe also partly just also the age that you are, how old are you?
I'm 34.
So the 80s, I mean, that would be like kind of the era that was just right as you were showing up in this world.
I think that it was more that my dad's record collection was like, he only liked a few 80s bands, but Tears for Fears were one of them, and Peter Gabriel was one of them. And my musical taste was all based on my dad's record collection. So it was Beatles, Pink Floyd, even like some kind of cheesy prog stuff like Yes that my dad really got into, and Steely Dan, which is, you know, there's merits to all that music, but some of it's kind of funny. But I think that that's really where the influence came from. It's just my dad's vinyl collection.
That's cool. Well, and as we go, you played at the Folk Alliance last night, and how'd that show go?
It was awesome. Folk Alliance is a beautiful, beautiful conference, and we're lucky to have it here, at least for the time being. And Angus, the director, he is on the same wavelength, that redefining, reclaiming the word folk to include the diverse communities of the world and their folkloric cultural music.
Our time is up. Enrique Chi with us from the band Making Movies. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And this has been a portrait session, which means you'll find Enrique's story on our website later today, along with photographic portraits by Paul Andrews at kcur.org. It's the weekend, but you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at kcurcst. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help this week from intern Matt Groby and KCUR's Laura Ziegler and Frank Morris. Linda Scher, Ron Yerman, and Suzanne Hogan, as well as Michael Byers, have run the board for us this week. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.